Mr. Sutton for the appellant, Ms. Bourne for the Attorney General's Office. Mr. Sutton, we'd be glad to hear from you. Would you care to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
3 minutes, if Your Honor, please.
All right.
May it please the Court, Ms. Bourne. Your Honor, we have before you the matter of Brian Lamont Moore versus Commonwealth of Virginia. The situation is this comes before the Court on whether or not the facts were sufficient to convict Mr. Moore of forging a check, uttering a check, and grand larceny of the funds from that check. As you can see from the facts in the case, Mr. Moore was an employee of Holiday Inn at Staples Mill and Broad Street. There was also a manager of that Holiday Inn, Mr. Peters, who ran another business called JPN Enterprises. Mr. Moore's duty at the Holiday Inn was the banquet chef. He had a mailbox and a place to receive orders near the office of Mr. Peters. On or about July 21, it is alleged that a check was missing from the account of JPN Enterprises. The facts as they were elicited at trial came to light that Mr. Peters, the manager of the Holiday Inn, also maintained the checkbook for JPN Enterprises in the same location in his desk near the what was called the executive office, where Mr. Moore would receive orders for his chef duties and things of that nature. It was found that on August 3rd, 2012, the check in question had been negotiated at a local Bank of America, and the check had been made payable to Jason Price. The memo said that the check was for kitchen work, and that Jason Price had in fact signed the check on the back when negotiating the same at the Bank of America.
Well, nobody sees him sign the check. The check was already signed, as I understand the record. But of course, a forgery involves any fraudulent making of a negotiable instrument like this. The question, nobody saw him do it, but the check is in one form, essentially blank except for a signature at one point. Next thing we know, it's in your client's hands and it's handed to a third party to cash all filled out. So, I mean, it seems to me what we got here is a circumstantial case, and I guess the issue, at least in terms of the forgery, which is only one of the issues before us, but at least in terms of the forgery, the question is whether the circumstantial evidence is sufficient to indicate that that he placed some information on that check to make it negotiable.
Well, I would agree that this is a circumstantial case, and I would also submit to the Court that the Commonwealth failed to exclude Mr. Moore's hypothesis of innocence, and that, as you heard and saw from the record, he acquired at least three loans from Mr. Peters during the course of his employment there. Mr. Moore says that when he received the last loan, which was approximately 3 days prior to the check allegedly being taken from the offices at the Holiday Inn, that he was given an additional check by mistake. Now, he had a roommate, Mr. Edwards. Mr. Edwards was a friend of one of the Commonwealth's witnesses, Christopher King. Now, it was the testimony of both Christopher King and Jason Price that brought about the circumstantial evidence that led to Mr. Moore's conviction. And I would suggest that even though the trier of fact is the best person to ascertain the credibility of the witnesses, what we have in this situation are material facts that were inconsistent. And Mr. King's testimony.
Well, we're mixing apples and oranges there a little bit, it seems to me. Let's start with the sufficiency of the evidence issue on the issue of forgery. And given that, we take the evidence to light most favorable to the Commonwealth. So let's assume we believe all of these witnesses, they're all credible as the fact finder found them to be. We have a situation where your client admits that when he first comes into possession of the check, it's blank except for the signature.
That is correct.
And then we have another witness, I guess it was King, testifying that when he's handed the check by your client, it's made out to the benefit of Mr. Price. And Price then also testifies that not only is the check made out to him, but Moore's the one who hands it to him. So given all of that, it seems to me the issue is whether the evidence could fairly, given the circumstantially, whether it be a reasonable inference that it went from being blank to being filled in by Mr. Moore, since when you combine all this evidence, it's while the check is in his possession that it gets filled out, which of course satisfies the elements of forgery, doesn't it?
It does, but however, if you look at on appendix at page 61 on King's testimony, he says, the appellant handed the check to me, I handed the check to Price. Price's testimony at appendix page 66 said, appellant handed the check to me.
Well, there's certainly a discrepancy there. The fact finder resolved it, and either it seems to me either way they resolve it. The point is that the check gets to the person who cashes it through your client, and at one point when your client acquires it, it's blank or essentially blank, and at the point when it's presented to somebody to cash, it's filled out.
Well, Mr. Moore presents a very credible explanation as to how this check
But that's not for us to determine whether it's credible or not. That's for the fact finder to determine.
Well, it's also for the fact finder.
And they resolved it against your client.
It's the Commonwealth's burden to exclude his hypothesis of innocence.
Reasonable hypotheses of innocence that flow from the evidence.
Which yes. They did if these witnesses are believed.
If they're believed.
Well, another thing we have to consider is if you look in appendix page 57, when questioned, Mr. King is questioned about transportation to the bank to negotiate the check. He says, at one point, he says he brought me the check. Me and Jason went up to the bank. I came home and called him, referring to the appellant. I've got your money. He came and picked it up. And then if we keep reading on down the appendix, he says, how did you and Mr. Moore get to Mr. Price's house? Picked him up in my car. All right, who was driving? Do you recall? I didn't have a license. Brian was driving. Okay, and Mr. Price, where were you in the car when you picked him up? In the back seat. And you proceeded to the Bank of America where you cashed a check. So now we have Mr. King, who does not deny the fact that he knew that Mr. Price had this check that had not been filled out but yet signed. He testifies under oath, impeached by his prior convictions, that at some point he and Mr. Price went to the bank, and then I called Mr. Moore and told him to come pick up the money. And then just a few questions later in the transcript, he says that Mr. Moore went to the bank with him. And then if we look at Jason Price's testimony, he says that Moore went to the bank with him, and is in controversy to Mr. King's testimony as to how they came into the possession of the check. King says that Moore gave him the check, I gave the check, then King gives the check to Price. Price says that Moore gave the check directly to him. So these are material facts that are inconsistent. And
counsel, again, we get back to the, you know, our standard of review at this level. I mean, those are good arguments to make to the trier of fact, but how do we get to the high hurdle that you're asking us to get to find that these are plainly wrong or without evidence to support them, or that it's not under the appropriate standard for the hypothesis of innocence?
Well, I think what you have to find is that the trier of fact erred in finding that these witnesses were credible when they make inconsistent statements about very material
things. I'll bet you can't point to a single case from either this court or our Supreme Court that says that if there's inconsistencies in witness statements, that makes them inherently incredible and all convictions based on those should be reversed. You're not going to find a single case that says that.
No, I'm not.
And I don't think you're going to get us to start now.
So I guess the point is, give us a legal argument other than, I mean, you're making factual arguments. Give us a legal argument if you have one.
I do not have one.
Okay.
What I have are inconsistencies throughout the trial by both people who had a stake in the trial. Mr. Price had felonies pending against him that were related to this case. He testified that he was expecting to receive a favorable outcome. And what I also find interesting is that this check was negotiated on August the 3rd. The owner of the check comes aware of it through some sort of internal audit, notifies the people in Richmond, the police get involved, and then on August 18th, just 15 days later after the check was negotiated, Mr. Price has shown a photo lineup that included the appellant and could not pick out the appellant, although he said that he rode with him to the bank to negotiate the check.
Mr. Sutton, you're doing the best you can for your client. You're actually doing, I think, a great job for your client. But I got to tell you, one of the disciplines for any appellate judge, any of us, is to sit, when we read these transcripts, this happens to me all the time, I'll read these witness statements, And I sometimes have to hold my nose, quite frankly, when, you know, when I say, I wouldn't believe this guy. But the fact finder did. The jury or the trial court judge, they did. And I'm stuck with that. And even though I might personally have come to a different conclusion had I been sitting on that trial bench and I've been the fact finder, the discipline for us is we have to take the evidence the light most favorable party that prevail, which includes accepting as true witness statements that I might have personal doubts about, and just simply applying the law in a rigid fashion that way. That's just the way it is for us. Well, and so while we all appreciate these factual arguments you're making, they are really better made to a jury or to a trial court judge than they are to us.
Well, I would suggest that the trial court was just plainly wrong in believing the witnesses. There were too many inconsistencies in their testimony, the inability to pick out the appellant of a photo lineup shortly thereafter the event, the inconsistencies about going to the bank and negotiating the checks and things of that nature were certainly consistent with Mr. Moore's version of how the check came into his possession, how it eventually came into Mr. King's possession, and how it was eventually negotiated at the bank. This being said, I would suggest that the evidence is insufficient to find that he altered, forged, or in any way participated as a principal in the second degree in the forgery of the check. Certainly the evidence is insufficient to show that he passed the check or uttered the check as a forged instrument. The evidence shows that Mr. Price was the one who went into the bank. Mr. Price was the one who passed the check. Mr. Price was the one who presented the check to the bank as a valid instrument. Mr. Price was the one who received the cash from the check. And I would suggest that the trier of fact was just plainly wrong in believing these witnesses. There were too many inconsistencies in their testimonies as to material facts, and I would ask that you reverse his convictions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Seidman. You have 3.5 minutes left for rebuttal. Ms. Bourne?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. There was no testimony presented, and it really hasn't been alleged on brief, that these witnesses were inherently incredible as a matter of law, which is, of course, a legal question that I think has to be separately alleged. It's just said, well, the trial court erred in finding the evidence sufficient because there was a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. But unless their testimony was inherently incredible, which it certainly was not, then the following facts have been established. That the defendant went into his employer's or his manager's office when he had no permission to be there, where he, from previous experience, knew checks were kept. That he had, and that's on appendix page 46, where his manager said he actually saw him going into the office and testified to that. That he had possession of a payroll check not written to him. That it was a JPN check, not the usual checks that he was given. That he asked King and Price to cash this check, this payroll check, allegedly because he had some problem owing the bank money. Certainly, I think the court can take notice of the fact that he asked somebody else to do this for him instead of going into the bank himself, which suggests that he has some sort of guilty knowledge. That when he went into the bank in the car, the check had already been filled out, both before he gave it to King and to Price. And that he had acknowledged that he had possession of it. That Price identified the check and said this was the check that was passed, and that check was in an amount that satisfies the statutory requirement of $200 or more, and that it was filled out the way it was filled out. That he gave the defendant money as he came out of the bank, and that the defendant received the proceeds of this transaction. And further, that he, of course, this whole story about how, which was denied by the other people testifying at trial, about how he came into possession of this check and how they came into possession of this check, which, of course, they denied being in his apartment at all. Receiving this check in that fashion. So certainly the trial court, faced with these completely different versions of what had taken place, could have looked at the defendant's testimony, chosen to disregard it, and considered that as additional evidence of his guilt because it was perjured testimony, and that's under Wright versus West. So we know that these are the facts because this testimony was not inherently incredible. And so therefore, the forgery, uttering, and grand larceny were adequately proved because there was a legal basis once these facts were established to prove forgery because he had exclusive possession of this check at one point, and by the time these other witnesses got it, it had been filled out. And of course, the Commonwealth need not even prove that, because they could have proven that he was an accessory before the fact, even if King had been the person to fill it out and they had been acting jointly in concert. That would have been sufficient. The same goes with the uttering conviction, because whether or not he personally went into the bank is immaterial. He asked Moore to go into the bank and cash a check for him. He received the proceeds. So he certainly encouraged him, incited him, and received the proceeds, and that's sufficient for accessory before the fact. And he received an amount of money which Price testified was the full amount that the check was for, which was over $200, although that issue, I would argue, was not preserved below. So unless the court has any further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. Mr. Sutton?
You know, I'm going to wait for the rebuttal on submission.
Okay. We appreciate that. Yes. We'll come down and greet counsel and take up the matter of...